So imagine this. A researcher walks into like a top-tier neuroscience lab. We're talking MIT or Harvard, somewhere massive.
Right, a real heavyweight institution.
Exactly. And he just totally bypasses the peer review board. He walks right past all those grant committees, drops a USB drive on the lead investigator's desk, and just says, "Here is the complete, mathematically testable blueprint of the human mind." And it'll cost you $50,000 a year to look at it.
I mean, when you frame it like that, it sounds completely absurd.
It sounds like a movie.
It really does.
Yeah.
But in a structural sense, that is exactly the scenario playing out right now in the world of cognitive science.
Yeah. And if you were listening to this deep dive, you probably know how traditional scientific breakthroughs are, supposed to
The
happen.
accepted path, right?
Right. You need a huge university, you need hundreds of researchers, decades of grant funding, millions of dollars. And then there's this really slow, agonizing crawl through the academic peer review
Yeah,
process.
it's highly institutional,
Yeah.
very generational. I
Exactly.
mean, it is an intentionally slow plumbing system.
Yeah.
The whole point is that knowledge is built incrementally. It gets vetted by thousands of eyes over years, and it's housed in these massive, heavily funded, ivy-covered silos.
But the stack of documents we are diving into today completely upends the entire model. I mean, it just throws it out the
It
window.
really does. It's wild.
We're looking at this private entity called the Brizard Research Archive, and it was built by this one independent researcher named Jason Brizard.
Just one guy.
Yeah, an independent outsider. And he has somehow engineered this complete interlocking theoretical architecture of human cognition. I mean, from basic perception to memory, all the way up to like apparitional phenomena.
Ghosts. He literally modeled
We
ghosts.
will definitely get to the ghosts. But the crazy part is he has done all of this entirely outside the university system.
And, he isn't trying to do what normally happens. He isn't slowly publishing it piece by piece in academic journals over the next 20 years.
No, not at all.
He is actively licensing it directly to those major research laboratories. Basically, it is essentially software licensing. But the software is theoretical neuroscience.
Which is just a huge paradigm shift. So our mission today for this deep dive is to tear this model apart. Because this isn't just about the cognitive theories
Though
themselves.
they are absolutely fascinating.
Oh, they are incredible. And we are going to get into the actual math of how they work later on. But really, this is about a structural revolution. Brizard is acting as an external theory division for established labs.
Right. It fundamentally challenges how theoretical science is funded, how it's generated, and how it's distributed. It just bypasses that whole academic funding cycle entirely.
Okay, so let's start with the bottleneck that makes a disruption like this even possible in the first place.
The friction point.
Yeah, because if you look at the FAQ document from the Archives Research Foundation, they outline the sheer economic inefficiency of traditional theory generation. According to their data, traditional labs are spending upward of $120,000 a year just to fund a single theoretical researcher.
And we should probably clarify what that 120,000 actually buys them.
Right, it's not just brain power.
No, exactly. When a university hires a theoretician, they aren't just paying for pure, uninterrupted thought. They are paying for institutional overhead, lab space, benefits, and these massive administrative burdens.
Yeah, all the red tape.
Right. That researcher is spending half their time writing grants just to justify their existence for the next funding cycle.
Exactly. They're teaching classes, they're sitting on committees, they're waiting like 18 months for a single paper to go through peer review. You're basically paying for the incredibly bloated process of theory generation.
Not the result itself.
Right. The lab is basically paying someone a massive salary to invent a completely new type of engine from scratch. And they're just hoping that in 5, maybe 10 years, that researcher eventually produces a blueprint the lab can actually use to run a real experiment.
And that right there is the exact friction point Brizard is attacking.
The waiting.
Exactly. The whole value proposition of the Brizard Research Archive is built entirely around bypassing that decade of waiting. For less than half the cost of that single theoretical researcher.
$50,000 a year, right?
Yep, $50,000 a year.
Right.
For that, a laboratory gets instant access to an entire suite of high-impact, publication-ready cognitive frameworks.
Just day one access.
Day one, the blueprints are already drawn, mathematically defined, and ready to be loaded into the lab's experimental pipeline right then and there.
But I mean, okay, I'm looking at this $50,000 price tag and something feels kind of off to me.
How so?
Well, I mean, yes, 50 grand is a lot of money to you or me. But in the world of institutional research budgets, where a single fMRI machine costs millions.
Right, grants are often in the seven figures.
Exactly. So $50,000 for a unified theory of the human mind is almost suspiciously cheap. It feels like a massive undervaluation of his own intellectual property.
It does seem suspiciously cheap at first glance.
Yeah.
But the source documents make it really clear that this is a highly calculated move.
Okay, so it's intentional.
Very intentional. The pricing strategy documentation explicitly states that the archive is currently operating in an early access mode. This $50,000 tier is designed for aggressive market penetration.
Oh, I see. So it's a loss leader. Get the top institutions hooked on the architecture now, and then raise the rent on everyone else later.
Precisely. The stated expectation in their business model is that as more prestigious labs begin testing these frameworks, and more importantly, publishing empirical results based on them, the perceived and actual value of the archive will compound.
That makes total sense.
Yeah, so the labs that buy in at $50,000 right now are getting a massive first mover advantage. They lock in long-term access to this architecture at a fraction of what it is projected to cost future licensees once the framework becomes the academic standard.
You know, if you work in tech or business, you're probably recognizing this playbook immediately. This is classic SaaS, software as a service.
Exactly.
You pay a recurring annual subscription for access to a centrally managed, constantly updated tool. But instead of a university licensing a cloud server from Amazon, they are licensing B2B theoretical cognitive science.
Theory as a service.
Theory as a service. I love that. But it completely shifts the role of the university, doesn't it?
It really does. In this model, the university is no longer the sole sacred generator of the theory. They are kind of downgraded, in a sense, to being the tester and implementer of a privately licensed product.
But here is the massive hole in this plan that I just can't get past. If the archive is built on open source principles, which the documents say it is, why on earth would a university with a $1 billion endowment actually pay the 50 grand?
Because they have to.
But what stops a lab director from just looking at the public website, pirating the core concepts, changing a few variable names to cover their tracks, and publishing it as their own discovery? Like, how do you actually force an institution to pay for an idea?
Well, that is exactly why Brizard can't just hand over a Google Doc and hope for the best. To make this business model work, he has engineered a very specific legal trap.
Okay, I love a good legal trap.
The mechanism that forces the universities to pay is a legal perimeter called ARLA, the Academic Research License Agreement.
Let's break down this trap, because this is where the disruption really gets teeth.
Right. So the genius of ARLA relies on a very specific deployment of copyright law. The core cognitive frameworks in the Brizard Research Archive are, in fact, visible to the public. But they are published under a remarkably restrictive Creative Commons license, specifically CCBY-NC-ND 4.0.
Okay, for those of us who don't speak fluent copyright lawyer, what does the ND stand for and why is it so important?
ND stands for no derivatives, and it is the absolute linchpin of the whole operation.
No derivatives, okay.
It means that while the public or a lab director can freely read the theories, share them around, and talk about them on social media, they are legally forbidden from creating derivative works based upon them.
Wait a minute. In the academic world, running an empirical experiment based on a theory and publishing those results, that is a derivative work.
Exactly. You nailed it. If a university simply takes the public framework and runs an experiment without permission, they are in direct, actionable violation of the intellectual property license.
Oh.
Yeah, they cannot legally publish their findings in any reputable journal because journals require clean IP chains. The no derivatives clause effectively paralyzes the university's ability to use the theory for actual science.
So they can look, but they can't touch. There's an analogy in the source text that illustrates this perfectly, actually.
The engine analogy, right?
Yes. Imagine this incredibly complex, high-performance engine. That is the Brizard cognitive architecture. The public Creative Commons license places that engine under a thick glass case in a museum.
Right.
You can walk right up to the glass. You can take photos. You can study the exhaust manifold. You can tell your friends about it. But you absolutely cannot touch it. And you certainly can't pull it out and build a car around it.
You are forced to remain a spectator.
Exactly. So ARLA is the key that opens the glass case.
Right. When a lab pays the $50,000, ARLA grants them the legal right to take that engine, install it into their own experimental vehicle, race it on the track, and publish their lap times. With ARLA, you go from being a spectator to being a driver.
That is brilliant. And when you open up the ARLA contract itself, you see just how meticulously Brevard regulates that racetrack. There are five core pillars to the agreement that demonstrate the rigorous control he maintains over the IP.
Do you want to walk through them?
Yeah, walk us through these pillars. How does this contract actually function day to day for a lab?
Well, the first pillar is the academic use exception. This is the formal legal carve-out we just discussed.
The VIP pass.
Exactly.
Oh.
It is the specific clause that waives the public bubble. No derivatives restriction for the licensed laboratory, giving them the legal breathing room to build experiments and generate derivative research legally.
Okay, that makes total sense. What's the second pillar?
This one is fascinating. It's called custom framework generation.
Custom frameworks.
Yeah. Because Brizard is acting as an external theory division, he offers a service where labs can submit their own raw, high-value empirical data directly to the archive. The archive then runs that data through proprietary internal analytical tools, specifically one mentioned in the docs called the Cascade module.
Okay, so what does this Cascade module actually do with the data?
Think of it as a theoretical translation engine. Raw neurological or behavioral data is often incredibly noisy and context-dependent.
Right, it's just a bunch of numbers and scans.
Exactly.
Yep.
The Cascade module maps the lab's specific data points onto the broader Brizard cognitive architecture. It identifies which variables in the messy lab data correspond to which parameters in his pristine mathematical models.
Oh, that's smart.
It translates raw lab observations into a bespoke custom architectural framework specifically tailored for that laboratory's ongoing research.
I mean, that sounds incredibly useful for a lab that's stuck, but let me guess there is a catch regarding who actually owns that custom framework once it's done.
A massive catch. The licensor, meaning Jason Brizard, retains exclusive, permanent ownership of any and all custom frameworks generated through this process, along with proprietary tools like the Cascade module used to build them.
Okay, I have to stop right there. I mean, isn't this basically academic theft?
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
Yeah. A university spends millions of dollars, maybe runs years of clinical trials, gathering this raw, high-value data. They hand it over to Brizard to be processed, and he legally owns the theoretical breakthroughs that are derived from the lab's own hard work.
It's aggressive for sure.
Why would any self-respecting lead investigator sign away their discoveries like that? It seems completely counter to the whole concept of academic freedom.
It definitely looks parasitic on the surface, but if you analyze the structural economics of the deal, it is actually a highly formalized exchange of risk.
Walk me through that logic, because right now it just looks like the lab is getting robbed of their IP.
Think about what the institution wants versus what the archive wants. The institution assumes the financial, physical, and experimental risk of running a laboratory.
Right, they buy the fMRI machines, they manage the human subjects.
They gather the data. In exchange for handing over the underlying theoretical IP, they get to bypass a decade of trying to figure out what their data actually means.
Oh, they get the shortcut.
They get an immediate, massive first-mover advantage. They get to be the lab that publishes the groundbreaking empirical paper proving or disproving a cutting-edge theory. And in academia, publishing the proof is what secures the next $5 million grant.
Right, that's what wins the prestige. That's what gets your name in Nature or Science.
Exactly. The lab gets the credit and the funding for the proof, while the archive retains the patent on the blueprint.
I see. So it operates as a defensive shield for Brizard, too.
Yes. He doesn't have to raise $50 million to build a lab to test his own theories. And the university doesn't have to spend a decade paying theoreticians to invent models. It's highly symbiotic.
A mutual exploitation pact. I love it. Okay, what about the other pillars of ARLA?
The third pillar is absolute confidentiality. This is a severe 5-year non-disclosure period applied to any unreleased or custom materials.
So no leaking the beta versions.
Right. It heavily regulates internal digital distribution. A lab cannot just dump the proprietary models onto a shared university server.
You can't just leave the PDF open on a library computer for a grad student to find.
Exactly. ARLA dictates exactly who can access the files, how they are stored, and places strict restrictions on visiting scholars who might, take the IP to a rival institution. They treat it like corporate trade secrets.
Wow. Okay, and the fourth.
The fourth pillar reinforces that corporate nature. It's the risk and liability allocation. The theoretical models are provided strictly as is.
Oh, that's software licensing 101. We provide the code. If it crashes your computer, that's on you.
Precisely. ARLA caps Brizard's total liability at the $50,000 license fee. It legally transfers all experimental, infrastructural, and reputational risk entirely back to the institution.
So if a lab bases a five-year, multi-million-dollar longitudinal study on one of Brizard's frameworks, and the empirical results come back completely null,
the archive cannot be sued for the wasted grant money. The lab takes the fall.
Brutal, but necessary for him. And the final pillar.
Mandatory attribution. This one is non-negotiable. It mandates a highly precise, standardized citation format for every single publication that is even partially derived from the frameworks.
What does the citation have to look like?
It requires the inclusion of the author, the specific framework title, and most importantly, a specific Zenodo DOI.
A digital object identifier. So it's basically a digital tracking beacon.
Exactly. It ensures that the archive's intellectual property is permanently tracked, quantified, and credited across the global academic literature. Every citation increases the archive's perceived institutional weight.
Okay, so we have this impenetrable legal shield with ARLA. We have a highly strategic SOS business model, but, you know, I still see a massive barrier to entry here.
Credibility problem.
Yeah. A legal contract does not prove scientific validity. If you are an independent outsider operating out of a private office without the institutional stamp of approval from Oxford or Stanford, how do you convince inherently skeptical, hyper-conservative academic institutions that your theories are rigorous enough to bet their reputations on?
Well, you cannot present your work like an amateur. You cannot look like a guy with a blog.
Right.
To bypass the institution, you have to outstructure the institution.
Which is exactly what the source document titled Integration Notes reveals. Brizard is actively subjecting the archive to what he calls massive structural changes.
He is stripping out all the conversational commentary, removing the philosophical noise, and migrating everything to match formal Zenodo data repository releases.
He is standardizing the revolution. This is formalized in a structure called TBF, the Brizard format.
Yes, TBF.
Let's unpack TBF. What does it actually look like for the end user?
TBF is a rigid, archival-grade publication standard. It forces every single theoretical framework, whether it's about memory or perception, to follow the exact same modular architecture.
So it's heavily standardized.
Very. Whenever a new component is released, it must contain a clear conceptual overview. It must formally define every variable. It must mathematically break down its internal mechanisms.
Oh, wow. So no vague hand-waving.
None. It has to explicitly state its integration role with the other frameworks, provide testable experimental predictions, and finally, offer implementation-agnostic pseudocode.
I really want to focus on that last part. The pseudocode. He isn't just writing paragraphs of theory. He is providing the mathematical logic gates that a programmer could punch directly into a laboratory's simulation software.
And that is the exact difference between philosophy and testable cognitive science.
The library analogy in the text for this is brilliant. If the individual cognitive frameworks are books, TBF isn't a book itself. It's the binding, the formatting, the Dewey Decimal System, and the cataloging rules that keep the library from devolving into total chaos.
That's a great way to put it.
Right. Because without TBF, Brizard just has a pile of really interesting, disconnected ideas. With it, he has a searchable, coherent, and rigorously structured scientific utility.
And analytically, this standardization is the only thing that justifies the $50,000 price tag. By making every theory structurally reproducible and mathematically interoperable, Brizard is proving that the archive is a unified project.
It's like an operating system for the mind.
Exactly. When a lab licenses the archive, they are buying a guarantee of longevity and structural integrity. They know that a framework published today will seamlessly interlock with a framework published 3 years from now, because TBF enforces that mathematical consistency.
Okay, so you have a sense of the business model. You understand the legal perimeter of ARLA and the structural rigor of the Brizard format. But we have been talking around the actual product for long enough.
Time to open the box.
What exactly are these major laboratories paying 50 grand a year to test? What is in the box?
This is where we dive into the cognitive architecture itself.
And looking at the scope of these interconnected frameworks, it is frankly staggering. I mean, this single independent researcher has built a unified system that models everything from basic perception to social identity to human consciousness to ghosts.
Yes, the apparitional phenomena.
Seriously, we are going to get to the fact that apparitional phenomena are mechanically modeled in this system. It's insane.
It is a vast ecosystem. And what is vital to remember as we unpack these mechanisms is that every single one of them is governed by that legal perimeter.
Yeah.
Every equation, every concept is owned by the archive.
Let's start where the mind starts, the entry point of the entire system, PFT, Perceptual Framing Theory.
PFT, right.
This is the model of how the mind constructs the frame of reality from raw sensory input.
To really understand PFT, you have to understand the core problem of neuroscience. The brain is trapped in a dark box.
Right, the skull.
Exactly. It has no direct access to reality. It is just bombarded with a chaotic avalanche of raw sensory data, physiological noise, and context. It is way more data than the conscious mind can possibly process.
The bottleneck of reality.
Yes. So PFT posits that perception is not a passive recording device. It isn't a security camera objectively taping the world.
It's not just taking it all in perfectly.
Not at all. It is an active, highly selective, moment-to-moment construction process. PFT is the mechanism that filters the chaos, selects what is relevant based on current needs, and constructs a coherent, stabilized snapshot, a frame, that tells your conscious mind what is happening right now.
The source text uses a film set analogy that makes this click perfectly for me. Imagine that raw sensory input is just unedited, raw footage.
Just a total mess.
Right. It's a mess. There are boom mics dropping into the shot. Actors are out of position. The lighting is wrong. It is chaotic noise. To make a movie, to make a coherent moment of reality, you need a lot of different elements.
You need the past, the characters, the direction.
Exactly. You need past scenes to give the current scene context. In this architecture, that history is provided by a framework called TFL. You need to know the character's motivation, which is provided by SST. You need the specific direction of the scene, provided by IRE.
And in that analogy, PFT is the director and the camera.
Right. PFT takes the history, the identity, and the intention, looks at the chaotic raw footage, and decides exactly where to point the camera. It decides what the audience, meaning your conscious mind, actually gets to see in the final cut of this exact moment.
And crucially, PFT is the foundational structure. Is the interface layer. Every other framework we are about to discuss has to inject its data into the PFT frame for you to actually experience it.
Okay, so let's talk about the character on that film set. SST, Simulation Synchronization Theory. This is the identity engine.
SST is brilliant.
And I found this profound because it models identity not as a fixed personality trait like, you know, I am an extrovert, but as a dynamic mathematical prediction loop.
SST completely reframes human identity. It argues that you do not have a static self. Instead, your brain is constantly generating an internal simulation of who you believe you are or who you need to be in a specific environment. Brizard calls this a role policy.
So who I am sitting here at a microphone is a different role policy than who I am at, like, Thanksgiving dinner with my family.
Exactly. You load up the Thanksgiving role policy, you act based on that simulation, and then you receive immediate social and emotional feedback from your environment.
Right. Did your family accept your behavior? Did they reject your opinion?
Did the interaction feel authentic? SST is the continuous comparative mechanism. It takes your internal simulation and measures it against the external social feedback.
And what happens if there is a mismatch? Like, let's say I tell a joke at a party, fully believing I am a hilarious person.
Right.
My simulation is I am funny. I tell the joke and the room goes dead silent. The external feedback is total rejection.
Well, in SST, that silence is mathematically computed as a prediction error.
A prediction error.
Yes. Your simulation predicted laughter. Reality delivered silence. The system cannot tolerate high prediction errors, so it has to update the simulation.
The documentation actually provides the exact reference pseudocode for this update, which proves how testable this is for a lab. It shows a core update equation.
Yes, the math is fascinating.
Listeners, try to visualize this. The new simulation state equals the old simulation state plus the prediction error multiplied by an effective weight.
So let's break that math down because it explains human trauma and human learning perfectly. The effective weight is the emotional intensity of the feedback.
Okay, so if I tell a bad joke to a stranger on the bus, the prediction error is there, but I don't care about the stranger.
Right, the effective weight is low.
So the multiplier is tiny.
Exactly. So prediction error times a low effective weight equals a tiny incremental adjustment to your identity.
Yeah.
You barely change. But let's say you tell that joke on a first date with someone you were desperately in love with, and they look at you with absolute disgust.
Oh, brutal. The effective weight is massive in that case.
Yes. The multiplier is huge. The resulting update to your simulation state is violent and immediate. You might literally recalibrate your entire social identity in a split second to ensure you never make that mistake again.
Wow.
SST argues that identity stabilizes only when the prediction error approaches zero over time. When reality constantly matches your simulation, you become the role.
That equation alone is worth the 50 grand, honestly. Okay, so PFT is the camera, SST is the actor constantly adjusting their performance via prediction errors. But PFT needs context. How does the past actually get into the present frame? That brings us to TFL, the temporal feedback loop.
TFL is the memory feedback engine, but it is vital to understand that it does not treat memory as a passive storage drive.
Right, it's not pulling a dusty file from a cabinet somewhere in the brain.
Not at all. It's a highly aggressive, active injection system. TFL operates in incredibly fast, discrete temporal windows. The documentation specifies roughly 100 to 300 milliseconds.
That is unbelievably fast.
Yes. Every few hundred milliseconds, TFL scans the brain's massive repository of past experiences, selects the specific memories that are mathematically relevant to the current moment, and feeds them forward into the active PFT frame.
So it actively injects the past into your current perception? It's like a writer revising a story in real time, aggressively pulling thematic elements from chapter one to make chapter five make sense.
And the selection criteria are key here.
Right.
TFL doesn't just retrieve everything randomly. It weights historical data based on your current affective state.
How you feel right now.
Exactly. If you are currently experiencing fear, TFL actively prioritizes the retrieval of past events associated with fear, injecting them into the present frame to help you predict the threat.
Which perfectly explains why when you are anxious, your brain suddenly floods you with every embarrassing thing you've done since the third grade.
Exactly. TFL is matching the effective weight of the past to the present.
It creates a continuous loop where the past is perpetually informing the interpretation of the present.
Amazing. Okay, we have perception, we have identity, we have memory. What about action? How do we decide what to actually do in the world?
That would be IRE, the intent resolution engine.
This is Brizard's volitional arbitration framework.
Volition, the whole concept of free will, is notoriously difficult for neuroscience to model mechanistically. It's usually very philosophical. But IRE solves this by treating competing human intentions as dynamic mathematical vectors.
Break that down for us. What does an intent vector look like in real life?
Okay, at this exact moment, you, the listener, likely have multiple competing intentions. You have a vector pulling you to keep listening to our analysis. You have another vector pulling you to check the text message that just buzzed on your phone. You have a third vector suggesting you should get up and stretch your legs.
The text uses a committee meeting analogy. Each intention is a committee member sitting at a table, just violently shouting for attention. Right. And IRE is the recursive arbitration loop that manages that chaotic meeting. These intention vectors compete mathematically. They're continuously evaluated based on three things.
What are they?
Their emotional weight, their alignment with your current identity simulation from SST, and their relevance to the immediate physical environment mapped by PFT.
So checking my phone might have a high emotional weight if I'm expecting a really important email, but it has a low alignment with my identity as a focused learner listening to this deep dive.
Precisely. As the IRE loop cycles every few milliseconds, the mathematical strength of each intention fluctuates. The debate rages on. But action only occurs when one of those vectors crosses a specific hard-coded mathematical barrier called the resolution threshold.
The resolution threshold. And the moment one intention crosses that threshold, the committee meeting is immediately adjourned.
Exactly. The debate ends, the vote is cast, and motor functions take over. You physically reach for the phone.
What I think is so beautiful about IRE is how it mechanistically explains human behavioral flaws.
Like procrastination.
Exactly. Procrastination isn't laziness. It's a mathematical stall in the IRE engine. If the vector to write the report and the vector to watch television are perfectly balanced, neither crosses the resolution threshold. The committee just argues forever in a loop, and you end up sitting on the couch doing absolutely nothing, feeling incredibly anxious.
Mm. It completely demystifies volition. It provides a testable equation for how the brain filters internal conflict into a single committed action.
Now, I have to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Go for it.
If all these incredibly complex systems, PFT building frames, SST computing identity errors, TFL injecting memories, IRE fighting over intentions if they are all running simultaneously, updating every 100 milliseconds, why doesn't human experience just shatter?
What do you mean?
Like, why doesn't reality feel like a chaotic, disjointed strobe light? It seems like too much is happening too fast.
That is the synchronization problem. And it is solved by the temporal backbone of the architecture, TCRF. The temporal coherence resonance framework.
The clocking layer.
Yes. Think of TCRF as the metronome of consciousness. Its entire job is to maintain the continuous flow of experience. It does this through an incredibly fast comparative process.
How does that work?
It extracts the unique temporal signature of the frame you are experiencing, right this microsecond, and it compares it to the signature of the frame you experienced a fraction of a second ago.
So it makes sure frame N matches frame N minus 1.
Exactly. If the temporal signatures align, TCRF generates a mathematical resonance that smoothly binds the two moments together.
And if they don't align?
If they misalign, like if sensory data is coming in out of sequence, it issues a correction to force alignment. It is the mechanism that keeps now inextricably linked to a moment ago.
It's the twist in the rope that keeps the individual fibers of time from unraveling.
Beautifully put. And working in tandem with that is VRIF, the Vibrational Resonance Integration Framework.
So what does VRIF do that TCRF doesn't?
While TCRF handles the timing, VRIF handles the density. VRIF doesn't generate any cognitive content itself. It is a pure modulator. It determines how tightly all these disparate cognitive streams, the memory from TFL, the identity from SST, the intention from IRE, bind together into a single unified moment inside the PFT frame.
Oh, I see. It determines the acoustics of the room.
Yes. If your VRF resonance is high, the orchestra of your mind sounds incredibly rich, unified, and deeply real. But if VRF resonance drops, perhaps due to extreme trauma or fatigue, experience becomes thin, the streams unbind.
Like dissociation.
Exactly like dissociation. You might experience a state where you feel disconnected from your own body because the identity stream has literally uncoupled from the perceptual stream. And again, ARA strictly regulates this coherence modulation mechanism as highly sensitive sealed intellectual property.
Which finally brings us to the outer edge of the architecture, the framework that tests the absolute limits of this entire unified model. RIET, the residual identity echo theory.
Deuce framework.
Yes, the ghost framework. I have to admit, when I first saw this in the stack of documents, I almost laughed.
It sounds absurd on paper.
It really does. But the deeper I read, the more stunned I became. Brizard has built an institutional-grade mathematical model for apparitions and hauntings, and he has done it without ever resorting to the supernatural. How on earth does a serious cognitive architecture model a ghost?
It approaches it entirely through the lens of effective neuroscience and predictive processing. It heavily utilizes the memory mechanisms of TFL and the identity structures of SST.
Break it down for us, because I need to understand this.
RIET proposes that human memory encoding is not uniform. During moments of extreme, overwhelming emotional intensity like terror, profound grief, or violent trauma, the brain doesn't just encode a standard memory.
What does it encode?
It encodes a hyperdense identity state. It records the exact posture, the profound affect, the precise environmental presence of that exact moment.
It burns an image into the screen, like striking a massive bell, leaving a permanent vibration deep in the metal.
Yes, exactly. It leaves a highly durable, localized, effective imprint in the neural architecture. Now imagine years, perhaps decades, pass. That imprint remains completely dormant in the brain.
Right.
But then a person walks into a specific physical environment that contains sensory or contextual features that perfectly match the original encoding conditions.
So the room has the exact same acoustics. The lighting is identical. The ambient temperature matches.
The environmental resonance begins to climb. The current PFT frame starts closely matching the parameters of the dormant memory. And if that environmental resonance crosses a specific activation threshold,
the room makes the bell ring again.
Exactly. The brain involuntarily reactivates that dormant identity state. But because it is so effectively dense, it doesn't just feel like a memory. The brain actually generates a vivid, quasi-perceptual, predictive simulation of the event.
Wait. Quasi-perceptual? Meaning the brain actually hallucinates it into reality.
Because the simulation is generated internally but triggered aggressively by external environmental cues, the PFT framework, remember, the director we talked about earlier, misattributes the source of the data. PFT assumes the data is coming from the eyes and ears, not from the memory banks.
So it literally projects the memory into the room.
The person experiences the reactivated memory trace as an autonomous external presence occupying physical space, an apparition.
An identity echo. That is just staggering. It completely validates the phenomenological reality of the person's experience. Like, they aren't crazy. Their brain actually rendered a ghost in the room. But it explains the entire mechanism strictly through memory reconsolidation, contextual resonance, and predictive simulation error.
Yes. It gives serious academics a way to rigorously study hauntings without losing their tenure.
It is the ultimate proof of concept for the architecture. It demonstrates that if you build a robust enough model of normal cognition, it can seamlessly explain abnormal phenomena without needing new laws of physics. Okay, I have to zoom out here. When you look at the sheer scale of this, PFT, SST, TFL, IRE, TCRF, VRF, Riot, we just spent 20 minutes walking through how perfectly they all interlock.
The synergy is incredible.
It really is. The math of the prediction errors feeds exactly into the temporal windows, which feed exactly into the volitional vectors. How could one human being possibly sit down and design this from scratch? It feels like it would require a supercomputer or a massive team of 50 architects to plan this out linearly.
Well, it does feel that way. But that is mostly because we have been deeply conditioned to view scientific progress through an institutional lens.
Right.
We assume theory is built like a skyscraper. You know, a master blueprint drafted first, then steel girders placed sequentially. This transitions us perfectly into understanding Brizard's actual methodology, which is entirely different.
The methodology of the outsider.
Yes. If you dive into the philosophical research notes provided in the archive, specifically a brilliant post titled, "Frameworks Are Usually Discovered Backwards," Brizard explicitly dismantles the illusion of linear design.
He argues that this entire massive architecture was never actually planned. It wasn't drafted from the top down.
He writes that there is a common retrospective fiction in science. We assume a framework begins with a grand master principle and neatly unfolds into its logical consequences.
But that's not how it works.
No. In reality, in the mind of an independent researcher, the order is completely reversed.
So how does it actually happen? Like, practically?
It starts as dirt.
Dirt.
Yeah. A researcher notices a tiny, isolated behavioral pattern in one context. Months later, they jot down a completely separate observation about memory. A year after that, they notice a structural quirk in how language works. For years, these are just scattered notes in a journal, partial intuitions, isolated, mathematically incomplete formulations.
But his point is that those scattered notes aren't the opposite of a unified theory. They are the unified theory in a latent, distributed state.
Exactly. And this is where he introduces his concept of recognition. The absolute genius of the independent model, the reason Brizard can build this while a Harvard professor cannot, is that the independent researcher has the sheer time and unmonitored freedom to let those local regularities sit in a drawer for 5 years.
Because in traditional academia, the system just doesn't allow for latency. A researcher is forced by the grant cycle to publish premature, siloed papers every 12 months just to secure their salary.
They are forced to build small, disconnected houses just to prove they are working.
They are forced to prematurely finalize their thoughts.
Right. But Brizard, operating outside the system, can just wander the landscape taking notes. He points out that the real heavy lifting of theory generation is not necessarily inventing new ideas out of thin air, but recognizing when existing, isolated ideas fundamentally belong together.
He calls recognition a second-order cognitive event. Break that down for us.
Okay. The first-order event is the isolated thought. This specific math explains memory. The second-order event is a moment of synthesis. It's looking back over 10 years of scattered notebooks and suddenly realizing, wait a minute, the math I used to describe memory in 2018 is the exact same equation I used to describe social identity in 2024. They are the same mechanism.
Wow.
He argues that naming the grand pattern doesn't invent it. It merely stabilizes it. The global map is only recognized retroactively.
So this organic bottom-up accumulation is exactly how a single person can build something so vast. He didn't build it from the top down. He realized that the puzzle pieces he had been collecting for a decade already formed a complete picture.
It is profound. And it ties intimately into his notes on language, which I think are the most structurally significant part of the methodology. Specifically, his dual concepts of lexical expansion and lexical drift.
This part blew my mind. Let's look at lexical expansion first. Brizard makes a hard claim. Our ability to explain the world, our actual explanatory power in science, is strictly governed by the vocabulary we possess.
Yes. The lexicon determines the boundary of reality. If you lack the words for a specific mechanism, that mechanism remains structurally invisible to your scientific models, no matter how much data you collect.
He uses the collision of spirituality and neuroscience as the perfect example for this. He suggests that for centuries, spiritual traditions and modern neuroscience have actually been describing the exact same underlying human phenomena, but they appear contradictory because they lack a shared lexicon.
They are speaking past each other.
Exactly.
Spirituality uses rich phenomenological words, alignment, intuitive resonance, spiritual connection, energetic fields. Neuroscience uses cold mechanistic words. Salience mapping, predictive processing, attentional weighting, synaptic pruning.
But the reference, the actual biological and psychological processes happening inside the human being often perfectly converge. By expanding the scientific lexicon to include formalized mathematical mechanisms for things like resonance in VRIF or identity echoes in Riot, Brizard is aggressively expanding the boundary of what can be formally modeled in a laboratory.
Which directly leads to his thesis on lexical drift.
Yeah.
And this is where he essentially calls out the entire academic establishment.
I have to ask you about this, because reading the text titled When Disagreement is Just Lexical Drift, he essentially claims that a massive percentage of vicious academic debates are total illusions. Is he really saying that scientists are fighting over nothing?
Structurally, yes.
That's crazy.
He argues that highly technical discussions between different university departments often appear to wildly diverge, not because their underlying observations of reality are different, but because the participants are using completely distinct lexicons to describe the exact same causal chain.
They are looking at the same elephant from different angles and fighting over the name.
Yes. Walk us through the specific example from the text, because I know you like that one. It makes this abstract idea incredibly concrete.
Yeah, the novelist versus the behaviorist.
Yeah.
So he compares a phenomenological sequence, how human action feels from the inside, to a mechanistic sequence, which is how a neuroscientist observes it from the outside. So from the inside, the human experience looks like this. A thought leads to a feeling.
Okay.
That feeling generates an urge. The urge becomes an action, and the action causes a shift in the environment.
Thought, feeling, urge, action, shift. That is the language of a psychologist or a novelist.
Exactly. Now look at how a mechanistic behavioral scientist describes the exact same event. Cognition leads to effect.
Right.
Effect generates motivation. Motivation becomes a behavior which results in a consequence.
Cognition, effect, motivation, behavior, consequence.
If you put the novelist and the behavioral scientist in a room together, they will argue endlessly about whether an urge is fundamentally different from a motivation. The ontologies seem miles apart.
But Brizard points out that when you strip away the surface vocabulary, when you reduce both sequences to their bare causal skeletons, they align perfectly, one-to-one.
Thought equals cognition. Feeling equals effect. Urge equals motivation. The grand academic disagreement is nothing but a translation problem.
It is the exact same internal to external cascade. And this highlights the ultimate advantage of being the outsider. By completely ignoring the partisan vocabulary of specific university departments, Brizard can ruthlessly strip away the academic jargon.
He identifies the core causal skeletons beneath the language and builds a translation matrix.
The Brizard architecture is interoperable by design, precisely because it refuses to respect the artificial lexical boundaries that universities spend millions of dollars enforcing.
It is stunning structural clarity. It makes you realize how much time we waste fighting over the labels instead of looking at the math.
It really does.
Before we wrap up this deep dive, I want to briefly touch on one final, almost poetic note from the archive, the philosophy of parallel storyline.
Oh, it is a beautiful synthesis of his work.
It really is. It's this idea that human life is not a single linear narrative thread moving cleanly through time. Instead, human identity is a constellation. It is a massive field of parallel, unfinished storylines all waiting in the dark for the world to trigger them.
A storyline or a role policy might stall for 10 years. It remains completely dormant. You forget it even exists.
Right.
Until you walk into a specific room or smell a specific scent or hear a highly specific tone of voice. And suddenly, that environmental cue crosses the threshold.
The arc violently reactivates and resumes its demand for closure. It beautifully mirrors the cognitive mechanisms we discussed earlier.
Like TFL injecting the past into the present.
Or Arette generating a ghost based on environmental resonance.
Exactly.
But more than that, I think it mirrors his own methodological journey. His scattered, isolated notes dormant in drawers for years, acting as parallel storylines that eventually triggered the completion of this massive, unified architecture. It is a fractal reflection. The theory describes the mind that built the theory.
It is an incredibly cohesive worldview applied simultaneously to the micromechanics of a single brain cell and the macro process of a decade of scientific discovery.
Okay, let's bring all of this together and look at the massive paradigm shift we have unpacked today. Jason Brizard is attempting to fundamentally disrupt the slow, siloed, grant-dependent nature of traditional academia.
He has bypassed the peer review bottleneck by acting as a private, external theory division.
Through the highly strategic $50,000 ARLA license, he has engineered a legal perimeter that forces universities to pay for IP while simultaneously transferring all experimental risk onto their shoulders.
And through the rigorous standardization of the Brizard format, he proves the work is mathematically sound and institutional grade.
He is offering major billion-dollar laboratories a fast track to testable, interoperable, cutting-edge cognitive science that models everything from the mechanics of a memory to the physics of a ghost.
It is a complete structural inversion of how we assume science must be done.
Which leaves us with a profound question to consider as we close. If an independent outsider, working entirely in private, can build a comprehensive, interlocking mathematical model of human consciousness and successfully license it directly to the most prestigious research institutions in the world, what does that actually mean for the future of the university system?
Right. Are we entering an era where the most profound theoretical breakthroughs in human history will no longer be treated as public, academic property, slowly built in the institutional cathedral? Will the blueprints of the human mind instead be treated as privately licensed, high-performance intellectual software?
It forces you to wonder if the entire academic establishment is about to become nothing more than a testing ground for private ideas. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the structures of how knowledge is built, who truly owns it, and how it is shared. Until next time.